Good Monday morning. Hey, it's April Fool's Day, and we're all here
April Fool's.
Make up your own joke. It's a roundtable on the roundtable. Joining me for the discussion, WAMC, is Alan Chartok. Good morning, Alan.
Good morning, Joe.
Newsman Ray Graff.
You know, is it an April Fool's joke that I have no headphone volume?
You know.
No, that's not the one.
You know.
That's the one. Thank you.
April Fool's.
April Fool's. And the...
Don't forget me.
The always very nice and the always very common. And I believe who has volume in her headphones. University at Albany journalism professor and investigative reporter Rosemary Armeo. Good morning.
Good morning.
Thank you very much for being with us. So we have a lot to talk about, a lot of interesting stories that are making news. And I just think the weird one, I mean, there's a lot of weird stuff in the news today. There's no question about it. But let us talk about this this case in Kaufman, Texas, where gunfire claims the second prosecutor after the daylight assassination of his deputy 2 months ago. Mike McClellan, the district attorney in largely rural Kaufman County, responded with a flash of angry bravado, denigrating the perpetrators as scum and vowing to hunt them down. A former Army officer who served in Iraq during Operation Desert Storm. McClellan carried a gun and refused to be intimidated, according to a friend in the local news media, even as his wife expressed unease, worrying that her husband, too, could be in danger. On Saturday evening, the authorities found Mr. McClellan and his wife shot to death inside their home in Texas. The killings galvanized law enforcement officials and frightened and bewildered local residents, many of them still shaken by the shooting of the deputy, Mark Haas, on January 31st. That case remains unsolved. And I have two thoughts about this case. One, there's what happened, which is so kind of interesting. Like, I don't really understand it, obviously, mm-hmm. as most people, I guess, don't. But also how some cases tend to break through and become that national story.
Mm-hmm. Well, this should be a national story. You've got two prosecutors killed. There's also a third death in Colorado that they're looking at,
right,
of another prosecutor. And the possibility that there's an organized group, the Aryan Brotherhood, perhaps, has been implicated as specifically going after law enforcement people. That's a frightening thing in a democracy, in a civilized country. We should be looking at it nationally.
Absolutely. When you look at the when authorities are still saying that it's too early to say if the deaths of Mr. McClellan and his wife were connected to the shooting of Mr. Haas, the county's lead felony prosecutor. But the killings of the two prosecutors in a county of 106,000 people in less than 8 weeks appeared to many to be more than a coincidence.
Right. And that those are just the three Texas ones, as I say, this one
right,
in Colorado.
Yeah. Yeah.
It does look like something's going on.
So what do we do in cases like this as far as how we respond to them as communities?
I think that you bring in every resource you possibly have, and you get them, and they will get them. I am sure of it. You know, there are some things that are not discussable. Pearl Harbor, you know, there was no question that once we were bombed on December 7th, we were going to get them. You get a small county like that, there are obvious choices to be made. There are millions of dollars in reward money that are going to be offered here. You're going to bring in the FBI and everybody else, and they'll get them. The question is, how many other people got first?
Yeah, I mean, I think this is more. This is not just about keeping control, keeping things legal. This is about the rule of law. If your prosecutors and your judges and your police are attacked, you don't have a civilization. This is how it breaks down, and that's got to get the highest attention of everyone.
No, that's right. You know, I'm not so sure I agree with you about one thing, and that is the rule of law. Because I have a feeling when they get them, they're really going to get them. You watch the killing of Osama, and when they went in there, they didn't want that guy with his hands up coming out and having a trial.
Oh, you mean when we invaded an ally and shot a man who had not even been indicted? Oh, yeah, I get what you mean.
But to Alan's point, the rule of law. I mean, what do we do? I mean, what is the way that we deal with this in our society?
Emphatically, I mean, I just think this is the one thing. Look, there are levels of legal retaliation. I mean, if somebody, one of us gets murdered, they'll investigate and they'll try their best. But when one of theirs gets murdered, let me tell you, hell will have, you know, I mean, it'll be unbelievable.
Yeah, I mean, the charges here are conspiracy, they're capital murder. You don't kill prosecutors and police officers and judges.
Or
and
jurists.
Or jurors, right. Yeah. And
what is that rustling of papers I hear? Do you have any idea?
Oh, that's me. I'm reading this article from the New York Times on this story here.
Oh, I see.
Should have done this last night.
I knew who it was.
Oh. I apologize. I'll try to be more stealthy.
Did you find another tidbit that we should be talking about in the story? I find it terrible.
Oh, that was so professorial. That was great.
What was that?
Did you like that?
That was great. Rosemary, just sort of throwing it back to her.
Or as we all say in classes, all of us say, would you like to share with the rest of us?
what you're talking about?
I can tell you that when the story broke over the weekend in Texas, the Dallas paper just through every single resource, and that's usually a slow day. They just brought in everybody. It's instantly recognizable as a huge and important and scary story.
It is a scary story. I was thinking something of like the shootings, different, but the shootings in Maryland and Baltimore where we had
the sniper stuff,
because you don't know, like right now we're not sure what's going next, you know, and it's scary.
Targeted law enforcement guys, and I would like to point out that the last prosecutor who was killed, he and his wife, he was armed.
Well, so. Yeah,
he was a soldier. For years and years. Yeah.
Do you think the bravado had anything to do with it? Of sort of, you know, they're not going to get me because I'm gonna have a gun in my hand. And
no, I think that was a sideshow. I think they're targeting.
Well, it's.
I mean, how can you, if you can kill a president of the United States, which John F. Kennedy, we certainly saw it happen. Right. I mean, how can you really protect anybody?
Yeah.
That's the problem.
Well,
I mean,
Kennedy.
I think it's an open car, and that's the last time you're going to see that.
If they're going to get you, they're going to get you.
Right, right. But here you have this wonderful president now. But obviously, the stuff you read on the internet is just so awful, so horrible. That you just have to say the Secret Service is doing a terrific job because you know that there are terrible people out there.
We want to talk about
happy note.
Well, yeah, I'm in awe of what they've been able to do.
We have another story, of course, which is another crime story, another story about what is happening in a murder trial. And this is in Arizona, and it is Jodi Arias who is on trial for allegedly murdering her boyfriend. And this is another one. I'll start off this way, Rosemary, because you were talking about, you know, it should be a national story. But how does this one break through?
Yeah, this is an interesting one to me because it's a different generation. My students and my own children are fascinated by this story. It's like OJ was. You remember our fascination with that?
Indeed.
This is this trial, and people are tuning into it every day. They know all the details. They're debating it. It's kind of outrageous. She's a beautiful, young, seems to be lying, young woman who's putting on quite a performance on the stand. And it's been all over.
Headline news.
Headline news.
I mean, this
yes.
has been, was it HLN? They've been doing, good Lord, 24-hour stuff.
You know, it's so interesting. Now, fill me in here. This is on television, right? So, in other words, it's live. People can watch it?
Big sections of it are live, yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
That state allows the televising
of
trials.
Correct.
Or the filming of trials. And that makes a huge difference in what people. Cognizance is of the of the goings on. It seems to me that this kind of thing is so attractive to a segment of our population, you know, that they can't stop. They can't get enough of it.
What does it say to about a criminal justice system that allows it then to? I mean, the reason we're talking about this morning is because today marks its fourth month, and a price tag costing Arizona taxpayers more than $1.4 $1 million.
To defend her.
Yeah, that's just a defense.
Okay.
Yeah.
Right, just to defend her. Absolutely.
Well, it's, you know, it's a distraction, as Rosemary says, used the distraction word before. People can't get enough of it, so they get it. It tells us that there are those who believe that the system is fair. Well, the system isn't fair. I got news for you. If you're of color, you don't get the same attention. If your kid dies or is shot in drive-by shooting, you know, it's not the same thing. If you're walking on the street while black, you get extra attention. You may get patted down and the rest of it. But this tends to legitimize the system. You see, we spend all this money, we defend, and we make sure that it's an honest way to do it.
But it takes – so to take that one step further, are you saying that if we didn't televise it, it wouldn't take 4 months?
I don't know. I mean, I would say if we didn't televise this, it wouldn't be the national show that it is.
Yeah. Wouldn't take 4 months. I mean, this is being played because of the looks of the player, the woman who's accused and her boyfriend, and the salaciousness of it. I mean, 27 stab wounds and slashing his throat and shooting him in the head, and she's dancing and performing on stage. I mean, it's a show.
Yeah.
It's a little disturbing.
And what if she wasn't attractive?
Yeah.
Well, that's what I was going to ask. And that's exactly the question I was going to ask, because what about Scott Peterson? You look at that case, and you have people like that aren't – what if they aren't an attractive couple? What if they aren't if there isn't something there? Casey Anthony is another one, of course, of just interesting of what it is about these cases that break them through.
Yeah, it's like satellite. I think satellite TV is doing this. It takes a juicy case. Those are all the ones you named are just horrible crimes. And
but how can you stand Nancy Grace for more than 10 minutes?
Oh, no, she's awful.
Oh, my God.
Just the worst.
Hey, now.
Yeah.
Are you
going to disagree with
that? No, I agree wholeheartedly, but I mean, there's no reason to take shots at Nancy Grace.
I think there are many reasons.
Yeah. Right, yeah.
I don't see any redeeming quality at all.
The fact that this country pays off to somebody like that, in other words, she is a star in a country, and she is really reprehensible. So so there's a segment of our population that just really gets off on this.
And reveling in – that was beautifully phrased, Ellen. Reveling in the horror of these cases, and exploit them to the fullest degree, and then, you know, 2 days later go off on Dancing with the Stars and then come back. I don't know. So
look at the newspaper every day, the Post, and now its competitor, the Daily News, which has imported its own, I think, Brit to run the thing, and they just can't keep up with the semi exploitative pictures every day. Who's got, you know, we have to read them here. We don't like it, but we have to,
to do our jobs. We have to read.
We have to look at this stuff. And it's getting worse and worse and worse.
So let me ask the question, and I obviously have some sense in the answer, but how is this different than if it bleeds, it leads mentality?
Oh, that's a good question, because, I certainly, lived by that as a young reporter.
Yeah.
I guess it's just the degree. It's 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, and you have to trump up a trial rather than just find new news, because you're doing it around the clock. I don't know. I don't get Nancy Grace. I think she is reprehensible, but so is Kim Kardashian, and I'm highly amused by her. I'm not highly amused by
her. Does she have a new show, too?
I wish she did. I'd watch that.
Would
but
you?
Nancy Grace, I don't get. I don't know.
But
she's shrill and not interesting, and she doesn't give all the news. She just gives her point of view. I don't get her.
Well, she has to be provocative, and she has to cater to a segment of the population that, you know, just really is very angry.
Now, what channel is she on?
HLN.
Yeah.
Headline News.
So it's used a CNN product?
Used to be the 24-hour CNN, and then they changed it.
But if you look at how important some of these, you know, daily soap operas are, then what really, what's the transition between all those people who watch soap operas and the people who tune into this 24 hours a day?
Well, and you know, what I think your point is interesting because soap operas have sort of gone by the wayside now, and people are maybe using this reality television, both scripted and unscripted, as the...
A very good point. This is the ultimate reality show. You're exactly right.
We're going to take a quick break. We're going to come back and talk about some other interesting stories. It is our April Fool's edition of the Roundtable on the Roundtable. Rosemary Armeo is here. Alan Chartek is here. Ray Graff is here. And you're listening to the Roundtable on WAMC. Welcome back to the Roundtable on the Roundtable. We love your input as well. All you have to do is email us, roundtable@wamc.org. You can also comment on our webpage or our Facebook page or by tweeting us at WAMC Roundtable, at WAMC Roundtable. We've been talking a lot about crime. Let us talk a little bit about how tough it is to be a kid these days. This is a new study and printed in the USA Today this morning. Unemployment rates increased 55% among those 18 to 34 years old from 2006 to 2011. This is a new analysis that sheds more light on just how hard the recession hit young workers. The report, which analyzes census data by young people's living arrangements, shows that perhaps not surprisingly, the highest jobless rates are among young men who live with their parents rather than on their own. One quarter of the young men aged 18 to 24 and one fifth of those 25 to 34 who lived with their parents didn't have a job. But the question is, according to researchers, which came first, living at home or being unemployed?
Sure.
My guess would be living unemployed,
yes.
Being unemployed, but I don't know. But I guess this is one of those things where the study also says that they do feel, looking at this data, that they will recover, but that it has been a very tough time. And they, again, use this term, the boomerangs, which are kids that move out, and then they come back, and then they move out, and then they come back. And 89% have helped with household expenses, 48% report paying rent, according to a Pew Research Center report out last year. So that's, I guess, gets down to what kind of parents you have.
Yeah, I did it when I was in graduate school.
Yeah.
And I moved out. I moved in with my buddies. We had a place. That all collapsed. And I came home for a while. I was welcomed, but it wasn't easy because young people tend to revert to their earlier roles in terms of what happens with their parents. The unresolved issues are still unresolved. You still act like, and somebody who is even outside with a job or teaching or whatever else can in fact start acting like he was a 16-year-old again. And the parents, of course, fall into the same thing, young man, while you're in my house, under my roof. And so it's very tough on everybody. Now, I think there are many wonderful people who are not like that. My parents were really great about my coming back. But we've been very lucky, the Chartocks, because our daughter and her life love spend every weekend with us. And we truly love that. They come from different directions. One comes from New Jersey. One comes from Boston. And we've been very lucky and feel terrific. But I'll tell you one thing. When there are dirty dishes in the sink,
oh boy,
I do not ever say a word. Never.
Except around here.
Yeah,
except
you do it
right
here.
Right now for before 10,000 people. Oh, you mean around here?
Yeah, I mean here. Yes, if you see a dirty dish, you do a page over the intercom.
I do a photograph.
Yes.
And then I put it on and say, who's responsible for this?
So,
but you're not my children.
Okay, so Sarah
and so,
is
it much easier.
Okay, so I'm a boomerang.
Yes.
I live with my mother. And my children and her other grandchildren come to visit all the time.
Yeah.
She's got, they bring their dogs, their significant others, their sports equipment. And my mother is ready to throw us all out of the house.
Really?
Just get out. Yes. She wants to be alone. Yes.
Well, that's interesting because
difficult.
There comes a point, and it may not be that long for me, before the kids really become caretakers in many ways.
And you bring up that's a great point. Because, look, there's no secret. Economy sucks, and it has for a long time. So what happens in prior centuries when times are bad, families stick together. And so we're going back to something that has been the way for hundreds of years. Families stick together, and they stay together longer. And this is just a natural way to go. And you're right, though. Things are now getting to the point where kids are staying so long that they're staying now for another reason, and that's to take care of the parents. And I've seen that, too. And it's not necessarily a bad thing.
Because
family's a good thing.
If you see the cycle, I think it's a great point, because if you see the cycle where you get people are getting married older. They're later. Older when they get married. They're waiting longer to be in a committed relationship. They're waiting
exactly.
longer to have children.
Yep.
And so now if you push that from what used to be early 20s to late 20s, early 30s, even into your 40s, and then you start that process, and then life throws you a curveball, and then you go to your parents, and now your parents are 70 or 80.
Yeah.
So it is an interesting dynamic.
You know, I have quoted this guy a lot. He's dead, and I loved him. He was a guy I worked with at the Eagleton Institute of Politics named Sebastian de Grazia. And he wrote a book for the 20th Century Fund called Of Time, Work, and Leisure. And he predicted 30 years ago that all of this was going to come to pass because we were automating, because there were, instead of everybody on the automobile line, there would be a few. We're seeing automated presses that put out newspapers and do all of this. And that is a part of a larger economic reason that all of this is happening. There aren't enough jobs, and there aren't going to be enough jobs. Every time I read in the paper that the United States should be a service economy as opposed to a manufacturing economy, and we should let the manufacturing go to China or to these other places, I'm saying to myself, yeah, but what about all the jobs? Why does it have to be one or the other?
Well, also, I think it's a type of job as well. I mean, sure. coming into all of us, I think, in this room at least, coming into a journalism, into a field of journalism. I mean, I've had professors tell me this in going to school, and it was certainly something that mm-hmm. that I embraced very quickly, which was, you know, you probably can't make it unless you live at home with a beginning job in journalism. I mean, my first job, which was a full-time job as a news director for a radio station, I made $11,000 a year.
Right.
Well, good luck. I mean, that's very hard. So, yes, I used like 4 or 5 years to stay at home so that I could build something up.
How did your parents act towards you?
Well, that was fine. My parents were fine as long as I was, quote unquote, moving in the right direction, which was, you know, I wasn't out of work. I was working very hard, and I was trying to get, you know, just trying to get my act together move on to the next job and to get more
money.
I
find this is a big dilemma for my students, you know, at UAlbany. And parents are a little more loose about maybe stay in school now and get a master's, you know, because there's not going to be a great job. So I'll spend the money now and keep on learning. Or they'll work part-time and continue to go to school part-time because there's not a great job really available right now.
But the question then becomes, Rosemary, is whether or not as they get more degrees, does increase their options.
Right.
Yeah.
And the cost, and I think that's a huge thing too.
The
so many people have so much debt that it how are you going to make that much money?
Yeah. We talk about this. I mean, basically, it has to be. It should be a gift from a parent, because if you're going to go into debt, it's just not going to. Then you have just such a huge burden coming out of school.
Well, I've never understood it, and frankly, I don't understand, because we talked to a wonderful young woman yesterday, I think, or the day before, who's a waitress and telling us that she was $100,000 in debt. That's a lot of money.
Yeah, it is.
Undergraduate.
And then comes the question of why people choose, for example, private institutions or independent institutions and are willing to take on this monumental debt. NYU, I believe, is $60,000 a year for an undergraduate right now. Think about that. Well, you know, the State University is more than it should be, but at least, you know, it's and by the way, when I ask my kids to this day, how many of you have a loan, a college loan? Every hand goes up.
Well, sure. I don't know.
Community colleges are another thing that I did not used to recommend. Now I don't know how you afford not to do that for the first 2 years. Oh, go sure. to those schools.
No, I think and the students they have there are incredible. I mean, that learning environment has changed. I mean, I was up speaking at one a couple of weeks
I
ago.
Agree.
I mean, those students are, you came are back just
raving
incredible.
About that.
Yeah, they're
right.
amazing.
The general education courses raving, are just as good, if not better, at the community colleges and the four-year schools, many of the four-year schools. So
we're going to take a break, and we'll be back and continue our roundtable on the roundtable. We have a bunch,
a lovely bunch of coconuts.
I think that is what I was going to say. Yeah. Actually, yes, we have a lovely bunch of coconuts, and we will we'll break them open and see what's in them. Coming up after the short break. Welcome back to the roundtable on the roundtable.
What?
Sorry.
Rosemary
Ray,
and I are doing some disco dancing.
A little dancing. Yeah. Yeah, very nice. You should bring that on the road.
And
it's
we stream
nice.
This. So if you want to see Ray
and Rosemary dancing, you can. Right.
Well,
got
there's,
that.
There's a little delay.
WAMC.org to catch that. You know, I have to say, I want to move on to another story in a minute, but the one thing that has really stuck with me over the last 12 hours was I think I was not alone here, but watching the NCAA champion or
Louisville Duke game.
The Louisville Duke game. It was the final of the Elite Eight games to determine who would go into the Final Four and be going to Atlanta. It was quite a rematch between Duke and Louisville. And you have Coach K, you have Rick Pitino, and it's set up to be this incredible, just incredible game. 6:33 left in the first half,
yep.
And a young man by the name of Kevin Ware, a sophomore, goes up to rather routinely to get a shot right in front of the coach, and when he came down, his leg seemed to snap in half below
it was unbelievable.
Yep.
the knee. And it was, I mean, without getting overly graphic, I mean, it was like floppy.
Yeah.
I mean, and yeah. So.
What do you mean like floppy? You could see
the bone came right out of this. Yeah. Yeah. And,
it
and so.
Came undone.
Like the bones here and then the.
It almost looked like special effects. I mean,
it
didn't look quite real, but it was very
real. And CBS, to their credit, showed it. Two times, I believe. They showed it twice, and I think they didn't realize the severity because it was off to the side. It was a far shot.
Yep.
And they had a because he was wearing a sock up, it was hard to tell exactly what was happening initially when you first saw it. And then they showed it once. And then they showed it again, and then everybody started to react to it. The kids on the court, from both sides, both coaches, the entire place went just silent.
Yep.
The kids who were right in front of him started to vomit, and you realize that
it was this
horrible, gruesome thing that had happened.
Yeah.
And then CBS obviously then stopped showing the video, which of
however,
course,
thanks to the internet,
it's
you can see
all
it as
over
many
place.
Times as you want. Yeah, it's quite
and
gross.
It is really gross, but at least you have the option,
free will.
Now, in the game, was it close in the first half? Because it wasn't in the second half.
Yeah,
it was close.
It was very close.
The kid said, "Do it for the Gipper." And got the people around. He talked to them, and they blew the other guys away.
It was a really good team.
Yeah, I mean,
it's
they
a
were
made for TV
but
movie.
But I mean, contrast this to the Joe Theismann play from 1986.
What was that?
It was a Monday Night Football, the Giants against the Redskins, and Joe Theismann fades back. Lawrence Taylor hits him high. Harry Carson hits him low, and the same thing happens to his leg. But They showed it about 78 times. I mean, you could see very clearly what happened. There was no question of, oh, we'll stop showing this now. No, they just kept showing it over.
Well,
and
the
over
difference
and
also,
over.
There was padding there, which this was, a leg just with a sock. So there was that. I also remember, like, that night, Letterman had the Joe Theismann pencil sharpener where his leg was the thing that turned around. Like, we were making jokes about it.
I would think that there shouldn't be any jokes about it. I mean, there's no place for that. But I would think that from now on, the person who hurts his leg the most in a game like that should get the Theismann Trophy.
Very good.
Okay, right. We should mention that the prognosis on the young player is pretty good.
Yeah, it's very good.
The Arthur Peterson set his leg and they put a pin in his tibia.
You are amazing.
I hate it when they
do the disco tibia music again.
A pin in his tibia. I was amused a little bit because as the game went on, of course, everyone had quite, as they should, great reverence for the poor kid. And, we're saying that, as he's watching his team rally back, and, I mean, he must be enjoying this while in great
pain. Right.
I'm thinking to myself, this kid is out like a light.
Yes. Yes.
At least, if not, I hope he is. Yeah. You know, yeah. I hope he is.
And those moments can really affect somebody's career forever. So, for example, if you're a senior and you break your leg and the scouts are looking at you.
Sophomore,
But he's a sophomore, so he gets
two
to go
more
back.
Years. Yeah. Well, we hope.
We'll see. That's questionable. Theismann never played again.
Is that right?
Yeah.
Well, he's an older guy too. I mean, we'll see what happens. So the prognosis
his mother,
is good.
I wouldn't let him go back. Oh my God.
Yeah, boy, they were there.
Sit there and do that physics homework.
It's quite
were the parents
a
there?
Yes, yeah.
Mm. But the good news, of course, Syracuse advances to the Final Four.
Absolutely,
which
that
is great.
The good news.
And that's going to be very territorial since we're New Yorkers. That Syracuse becomes the. We all have to root for Syracuse, right?
Well, you wouldn't want to?
No.
Our signal gets into Syracuse.
I'd be cheering.
Our signal gets into Syracuse.
It's your alma mater?
Yeah.
Brian Shields as well.
Let's cheer the Orange. And last time they were here in Albany.
It's one more example of tribalism as far as I'm concerned.
Oh, come on.
Our tribe,
it's opening day of baseball, and you pull this every time.
I'm so sorry.
Let's talk. All right, let's talk about one of our favorite topics here, and that is the New York Times.
Oh, I really think they screwed up this time.
Oh my God, what have they done?
They wrote an obit on a famous scientist, a remarkable woman.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. The woman by the name of Yvonne Brill.
Right. And she is a pioneering rocket scientist, a woman who was in a field that not many women did it all, much less did to the level she did. And the lead to her obituary said she made a mean beef stroganoff, followed her husband from job to job, and took 8 years off from work to raise three children. Her son called her the world's best mom.
Wow.
Outrage. Explode it.
I mean, don't you
as
put
well
that,
it should.
That's okay, but don't you put it down about four paragraphs?
Sure. Yeah.
Well,
sure, it's her background.
That's burying the lead. Burying the lead is that one of the world's foremost rocket scientists who is just in the White House being honored by the president. By the president of the United States. Mm. Maybe that would be the lead.
Yeah, yeah, very bad.
So then they get all people like me screaming at them what idiots they are, including their own ombudsman. And they fix it. And the new
lead.
How
do they fix it?
They fix it. The new lead is.
Quote unquote.
She was a brilliant rocket scientist who followed her husband from job to job and took 8 years off from work to raise three children. The world's best mom, her son said.
Oh, boy.
Still lousy.
You don't say.
And their defense was, well, we took out the beef stroganoff line.
Yeah.
I thought, oh, my goodness.
My God. I can remember a few years ago, many years ago, when, do you remember Renee Richards? She was one of the first transgendered tennis players.
Transgendered.
Right. Yeah. And I was working for the UPI, and they ran a story about.
Was on
the
show, actually, yeah.
Oh, yeah. She's a very interesting woman. But anyway, they ran a story about one of her matches, and it said, Renee Richards acted like any woman after she lost. She sat down and cried. And I thought that was okay, too.
Yeah.
Ah.
What do you think the people at the Times are thinking right now? Are they thinking, well, you know, we're getting beaten up quite badly for this, and, you know, obviously there's no defense for it from the feminist community and for what we've done here, but we got an awful lot of coverage.
Yeah, they got the name right.
Yeah.
Boy, I hope that's not what they're thinking. I mean, this isn't just about feminism. This
right.
is, you know, men and women both deserve recognition for their accomplishments.
Okay, so let me ask you a question just for the hell of it, Rosemary. I don't like to fight with you, as you know.
I know, especially when I'm yelling.
And also, you're brighter than I am. And so, the question would be, if the New York Times had written a story in which the first about some famous person in which the guy's kid, boy or girl child, said to them, you know, he was a great man, but he was best at being a father. Would that have been different than if it was a woman?
Again, I think that's fine, down a little further.
I think in any case, if you have a rocket scientist and a pioneering rocket scientist who, again, was just... male or female, was just given a major award at the White House by the President of the United States. That, to me, would be the lead.
Okay, I'm going to even go further and say that even if people say it about themselves, it's up to the media to write the truth. When Dan Rather died, there was a lot of bullshit. Dan Rather died. Yeah. Sorry, not Dan.
Oh, okay. Oh, yeah.
Oh, my God. I'm sorry.
Breaking news.
No. Dan Rather is very much alive.
Okay.
Hello, Dan Rather, okay.
Right. 60 Minutes guy.
Mike Wallace. Okay, Mike that Wallace. Guy.
Dan Rather alive.
Mike Wallace dead.
Yeah.
All right.
Dan Rather alive.
Right.
All right.
When Mike
April
Wallace.
April Fools.
You got us, Rosemary.
That's horrible. Oh,
it's
horrible.
Good.
Okay.
When Mike Wallace died, there was a lot of writing about how the most important thing he accomplished in his life was to bring his family back together after they had, you know, he had split up with wives, but he got everybody back together.
Severe depression
well,
that he went through.
Yeah, baloney. That is not the most important thing that he did. He was an amazing investigative reporter. He changed television news. That's what he did that we should be writing about. And you put the family stuff at the bottom.
So you're the journalistic expert, Rosemary. So isn't one of the rules in all of this that they're following, which is find the human part of this and give that as the come on to all the people who are reading, because they're going to be much more interested in their motherhood. They're going to be more interested in this or that than they are in their accomplishments.
Oh. Alan, it's human that a woman was an amazing, brilliant
No, but I'm
scientist.
Not arguing that. I know that, and I agree with you. Don't let anybody ever think that I don't agree with you. I'm trying to get inside their minds by
to
understand what they do.
When your first line is, she made a mean beef stroganoff, I mean, what does that have to do with the...
Yeah. I mean, maybe she did.
With the story. Well, I'm sure. I mean, that's fine. But so the Times public editor, Margaret Sullivan, chimed in saying that she agreed with the criticism and linking to a article from CJR, Columbia Journalism
right.
Review, about how news coverage of women scientists often leads to gratuitous gender profiles. So basically saying we screwed
right.
up,
yeah.
but look, we did what everybody else does.
Yeah.
So why did, okay, look, I'm sorry for beating this animal, but the horse.
I think I see what you're getting
at. I want to know what the motivation is. Are they just dummies? I don't think so. I think what happens is they're sitting there and they're saying, what will get more people to read the piece?
I think he wanted a contrast. When you look at the whole piece, it's like, oh, she made a mean beef stroganoff and her kids loved her and she followed her husband. And then the second paragraph is like, she was also this amazing scientist. So he wanted to do that contrast. She looks like a little old lady and what she really was is a brilliant mind.
Right.
I think that's what he was trying
now,
for.
Now, you know, as a journalist and a feminist, does it offend you more the sentence, you know, she was a brilliant rocket scientist, oh, by the way, who followed her husband from job to job.
Like I said, the rewrite is just as bad as the first one. It's horrible.
Yeah. And it's one of those things. It took, this came out on Wednesday, And, you know, still over the weekend is when we started to yell and scream about this. So it's interesting how long it takes for these things to really do to go viral. And,
right. Well, Yvonne Brill won't complain, but maybe the New York Times will learn a lesson.
As I get older.
Well, there's one less good beef stroganoff.
I have to say, as I get older, I tend to read the obits a lot.
Yeah.
And, you know, there's that old Lee Hayes from the Weavers who, you know, who said, I get up in the morning, I look in the obits. And if I'm not there, I go back to bed.
Where you know it's going to be a good day. It's fascinating stuff. And you know, you'd like to say, well, they won't make that mistake again. But you're pretty sure that they probably will make that mistake again.
That's why I tried to get to their motivation.
Yeah.
See, that's why the basis of predictability in science is based on what they think they're getting out of it.
Yeah, I think Alan is right that was an attempt at ironic writing and
or
it just
universalizing
came off totally
it. Yeah,
right.
Sure.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, as evidenced by the rewrite, which was, as you said, worse than the. Well, that is not worse, but
that's
not much
bad.
Better.
I like these sure enough.
Me too.
Do you like rockets?
And I love rockets.
Particularly.
It's April Fool's Day. When we come back, we're going to meet a woman who is an expert on April Fool's jokes. Julie Winterbottom will join us and talk about pranks and what we can do today to make it an extra special April Fool's Day. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC. Welcome back to The Roundtable. It is our April Fool's edition of Roundtable on The Roundtable. And because it is April Fool's Day, we wanted to bring in an expert. This is a woman by the name of Julie Winterbottom, who has written a book called Pranklopedia, The Funniest, Grossest, Craziest, Not Mean Pranks on the Planet. We'll ask about the not mean part in just a moment. But Julie Winterbottom joins us on the telephone. Good morning, Julie.
Good morning and happy April Fool's Day.
And to you, thank you very much. Julie has worked for years as the editor-in-chief of Nickelodeon magazine, fulfilling her dream of getting paid to be a prankster and class clown. So what makes a good April Fool's joke?
I think picking a target well, someone who has a sense of humor, is important. Making it sort of, it can have a little edge, but I don't think anyone should end up feeling really awful about themselves or humiliated, especially if it involves a kid. And then, in my mind, quick and easy is kind of good for most people. If you're a very serious prankster, you can get into some extremely involved planning. But most of the pranks in Pranklopedia are quick and easy.
Tell us a great one.
Well, there's a good one you can do in the morning. It basically, you prepare it the night before. You mix some lemon jello with hot water and pour in orange juice and put it in an orange juice glass. Stick it in the refrigerator overnight. The next morning, you just set it out on the table for your victim. They pick up the glass of orange juice and try to drink it, and it's just solid in the glass, doesn't budge. It's really easy and has a good payoff.
a good payoff.
Yes.
As I mentioned in the subtitle of the book, The Funniest, Grossest, Craziest, Not Mean. And I think a lot of us think of April Fool's jokes as that they can, there's a fine line, isn't there? I mean, there's a balance where they can be kind of nasty.
Yeah, I mean, especially these days, you see a lot of stuff that shows up on YouTube and it's mostly grown-ups, but some of it is pretty nasty and there can be hurt feelings, and when it goes viral, it's even worse. But, you know, I really went overboard with this book because it's aimed at kids 8 and up. I think a lot of juvenile adults will enjoy it, but I made sure...
Well, that's why we're here.
Exactly. I made sure that, you
give
know,
that to him.
they're not going to leave anybody in tears or feeling horrible.
I mean, let us note that on the front cover of the book, there's a young man and a little cartoon kid, and then it says how to make fake snot.
Yeah.
Page 136.
Yeah.
Fake
snot.
Yeah. Oh, snot. Yeah.
Snot.
Sure, why not?
Yes.
I know nothing about it.
I said juvenile.
Yes, you don't know anything about the fake stuff.
It's not funny.
Hey now. Oh, boy.
you do the whole hot shoe thing, and you got the big glob, and that's always a good joke, right? That's good, clean fun, as it were, right?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, there it says not mean, but it doesn't say not gross. And, you know, there are a lot of 9-10-year-old kids out there who will love the fake snot and the fake vomit, and I have all of that, but there's a lot in here that's not gross. So it's really going to have something for everyone.
My father used to tell me a story of when he was a kid. He lived in he lived not far from where Alan grew up. He lived on 99th Street and
97th, I thought. No, 99th?
99th.
Okay.
And I don't know.
He and I had a long talk about it.
Yeah, and
because he went to the Holy Name School.
Right. Yes. Yep. Yeah.
Is that where you went?
That was a holy. No.
No, it wasn't where I went.
That was not where he went. But it was a. There was a whole story there. Anyway.
Yes, there was.
So my grandfather, apparently, who I never met, was very much a very superstitious, and he was a bookie, and he was very superstitious.
Uh-huh.
And one of the things that he never wanted, my father always wanted a dog. So one day he said, "Hey, I got a puppy for you. Come on out, I got a puppy for you." And he goes out, and there's a box there, and there's this like whimpering and this kind of scratching on the side of the box. And my father is elated to realize that his father finally, after years, has gotten him a puppy. And he runs in and looks, and there's a piece of paper there that says April Fool's.
Ooh.
And like my father was crushed by this as I
he
think
must
you
have been,
would
he remembered it for the rest of his life.
For the rest of his life. And to me that was sort of the quintessential like that's what my grandfather was like story.
Yeah.
So here again getting into this point of you don't want to fool around with kids and you don't want to make them too mean.
Do you have any terrible ones that you can tell us that have happened that have made people really upset?
I do. It's a prank I pulled in my 20s on my dad, and it really sort of backfired. I had just moved to New York. I was making very little money. I used to be a huge fan of modern dance. He is very into the arts, and he gave me some money and said, "This is expressly for you to go see some good modern dance performances." I went to one, and the next day, instead of just calling him and saying thanks, I typed up a fake letter with the letterhead for the director of the dance company and this whole description of how the director said that he had met me after the performance and I told him that my father had funded this and that was wonderful and thank you. And I sent it to my dad. At the time, my dad was working for an organization that was testing high school students in performance arts and they needed someone for their dance panel. He wrote back to this guy and invited him work with them.
Oh,
and a few weeks later, I said, "Dad, did you ever, you know, I love the dance performance. Did you ever hear anything about it?" And he said, "Yeah, I wrote back to the guy." And I was just mortified. I told him what happened, and he did not think it was funny.
No.
No.
Happy
no.
way to end the segment.
Do we have any time at all? No.
Well, we're out of time, but I want to remind people that Pranklopedia is really funny, and so if you want to avoid all of the horror stories that we talked about, they're the funniest, grossest, craziest, not mean pranks on the planet, and Julie Winterbottom has put this whole collection together, and it's a very fun book and a fun thing to have for your kids and for yourself, and Julie, we wish all the luck in the world. Happy April Fool's Day.
Thanks, and same to you.
Thank you very much. The book is published by Workman, and we appreciate you taking the time out. I also appreciate Rosemary, Alan, and Ray. Thank you very much for being here.
Nice, Joe.
Spirited conversation. Thank you.